Welcome back to Spotlight Middle East. Right before the break, we were talking about the Russian power, along with the axis of power, perhaps the Russians, along with the Chinese and the Iranians. The upcoming election will be harsh, and as the UN said, it will be divisive. Allow us to talk about how we can control the situation. An analysis said that even if the Russians put some pressure on some rival groups within Iraq, in order to back up Nour al-Maliki government, in order to back up the groups that are opposing sectarianism, it might be hard to stop Saudi Arabia from moving on with its plan. It might be hard to limit al-Qaeda, knowing that al-Qaeda is emerged from Saudi Arabia and sent within Iraq. How can we actually control that?
I think the best way to control the situation is to end with the problem from the root. This is like if you have an open wound and you just put makeup to try to cover the situation. Here, the big tumor in this situation at this point is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is financing the insurgency. Saudi Arabia has its own Islamic extremist project for the region, and that's what's provoking the turmoil. If Russia is trying to mediate with groups in Iraq to try to find a solution, but at the same time Saudi Arabia continues their financing and their war in the way that they understand it, I think it's very little that we can do. I think internationally the best way that we can fight against this terror would actually be isolating this nation, the Saudi Arabia, and finding ways.
How could that happen? Isolating the police of the region, you know, that the U.S. put Saudi Arabia as their police in the region in order to control things, and especially using terror. How can we limit Saudi Arabia?
This is actually very complicated. This is an utopia that if we can find the mechanisms with the United Nations Security Council to find a way to put pressure on a nation that for the past years is creating just terror, not just in the Middle East, but it's also financing al-Qaeda openly and their activities all around the world. How can we finish with that? How can we put pressure on Saudi Arabia? Putting it on the United States.
Even the United States are afraid from the repercussions. They said that the plan that we assisted at the beginning today will backfire on us, and which happened lately. Even the U.S. is afraid of doing that.
Okay, but the United States was capable of putting pressure on Saudi Arabia to get rid of the chief of intelligence, this Prince Sabatan, and eventually things have turned in a different way. They are, I don't know if it's for real or not, they're supposedly prosecuting by making a list of the most dangerous Saudi terrorists to put them in prison or to avoid that they go, for example, to fight in Syria. So it's a step. It's a step that really is an interest by the United States. These nations would actually stop creating this atmosphere of terror. I don't just mean for Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. but for Israel too. But at this point, they're fully supporting these regimes that are creating this terror in the region.
Away from al-Qaeda, away from the terror in Iraq, allows to talk about the corruption within the government. We have the poor wastewater treatment, we have the rampant corruption, and we have the high unemployment. Do you think that the upcoming government could actually control that and put some changes that Iraq really deserves?
Well, that depends also on how countries like we said before, like Russia, like China, and like Iran, for example, they get really involved to find a solution, a permanent solution for the region, and they will be willing to find the possibilities of financing a permanent peace. I think it's very, very complicated. Actually, a rich country in resources like Iraq that has this corruption, this terrible corruption at this point, this very high percentage of unemployment, and I don't know if this can depend also or only in the political will
so
of the new government.
Basically, yeah. Iraq and any other Arab world today is reliant on outer powers to actually amend and to fix its future and its governments.
At this point, yes. Let's not forget that Iraq is not the Iraq that it was 15 years ago, that it was a self-sufficient nation with a military capability, with a kind of a strong economy, with a free education and free medical care and assistance. Today, what governs, what has become out of Iraq is total chaos. And I'm not sure if by themselves, they can really fight to change the situation. I know Maliki has been trying very hard in the past years, but I don't think it's enough. I think we have to involve the international community. And if the United States is not willing to do it, or the European Union, I think that Russia probably has a very good possibility and very good chance of proving that actually they want to create peace in the region.
Well, let's move on to our last part of our show, where we talk about how Iraq is actually being affected by the Syrian situation. And at the beginning of the crisis in Syria, they said that the same plan and the same aims and goals that were set in Iraq are being put into Syria, trying to break a self-dependent country and a strong country apart in order to be able to get rid of the neighbors and perhaps get rid of the resistance path that was a threat to Israel and the Americans. How is the Syrian situation affecting Iraq, in your opinion?
Well, as I said before, the aim of the insurgency in Iraq basically is to create this nation cut into bits and pieces. And one of these big projects is this project that the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant has, not just for Iraq, but also for Syria and even part of Lebanon. At this point, I think that if we cannot fight back this project, Bashar al-Assad at this point is regaining a lot of the territories. The involvement of Hezbollah at this point is making Hezbollah strong, even though they have lost over 500 militants in the war in Syria. But it's making more secure the borders between Lebanon and Syria. And they're fighting the insurgency really, really strongly. Unfortunately, yesterday, I have to say that three colleagues of ours...
Definitely, in Al-Manar TV.
That's correct. One of them,
Hassan,
I happen to know, which is Hash Hassan, who I, funny enough, I was together with him just a couple of weeks ago. We were covering the news of the car bomb in Nabi Otman while we were interviewing the mayor of Labuan. Six rockets fell very close to us, and we happened to be together interviewing this person, and I saw in this person a very, very nice human being, a very young, very good professional, but it was not just in the mixed fire that he got killed. He was targeted because he happened to work in a broadcast that is linked to Hezbollah. Hezbollah represents a danger, as you said, as resistance, represents a danger for one of these nations in the region that is also creating the big turmoil, which is Israel. The capabilities that has achieved in comparison with the 2006 war has made much stronger Hezbollah. Intervening in the war in Iraq has given capabilities, offensive capabilities that were 2006, they only had defensive capabilities. Mm-hmm. They have new weapons, they have new possibilities. I think they're fighting better in Syria, the insurgency, much better than what is going on in Iraq, where there are areas like Fallujah that are totally out of control.
Basically, if we can talk about the security plan that should be embedded in Iraq and that should be embedded in Syria as well, and in Lebanon, because Lebanon is also under attacks of terrorism and suicide bombers. How can we control suicide bombers? I mean, a lot of the Iraqis, a lot of the Syrians and the Lebanese are always putting blame on the Ministry of Defense and saying, why aren't you protecting us from such hands of terror? Could it really be easy to protect from suicide bombers?
Well, it depends, because the suicide bombing phenomenon is a very, very difficult element actually to fight. Now, if we can use, for example, the example of Lebanon, I think it's a very good example of political will to fight terrorism, together with the help of the government and the army of Syria. From the moment that Jabrut was liberated from the insurgency, that was this town in the Kalamon area where most of these car bombs were prepared to be brought into Lebanon to be exploded, especially here in the southern Beirut. But it was this will, this political will, that finally made this government implement this security plan that is stopping this element from coming from Syria, and at the same time, the army from Syria liberating those areas where actually these people are operating. I wish that we could see the same in Iraq. As I said before, Iraq seems like a territory out of control at this point. It's out of control also because the borders don't represent a secure possibility. Having Saudi Arabia so close by, I believe that it's creating much more of a turmoil than, for example, what is happening around here. I am very optimistic for Lebanon. I am actually quite optimistic for Syria, but I am, again, I say, unfortunately, very pessimistic for Iraq.
Let's hope that things do change and a miracle comes in and actually changes the goals and the aims of the Hands of Terror. Allow me to end my episode by a letter that was sent from a child, an Iraqi child that is living in California and states, Amina Saraf wrote this at the time of Saddam Hussein to the Iraqis, and he said, "Dear suffering children of Iraq, we understand your conflict, but we cannot feel your pain. We read horrifying statistics and we still cannot feel your pain. We understand the threats of our bombing and the effects of the sanctions against you. We try to do what we can to help, but we still cannot feel the pain that you feel. The amount of children dying monthly are thousands. Sure, the statistic hurts, but your pain does not come with it. We can live without breakfast or lunch, but not almost every day of our lives like you are. As Muslims also, we fast, but only for a month and only during the day. Most children do not fast and are not required at a young age. Living in Iraq, you have to fast every day, sometimes all day long. We learn about your government in our schools and we see that it is different from ours in many ways. We do not live in a dictatorship, we live in democracy. Although we value democratic principles, sometimes our policymakers do not uphold their principles when dealing with foreign countries. Most of us have never lived in a place ruled by a military dictator. We feel scared to think of what it would be like, but of course we do not feel your pain." That letter, of course, was written back at the time of Saddam Hussein, and speaking of such sufferings by children, we are seeing that same suffering today on a daily basis, despite the fact that Saddam Hussein is not there. There are still some hands of terror, there is still some corruption that is actually causing not only children, but the people of Iraq as a whole to live the sufferings on a daily basis. Mr. Alberto Garcia, I want to thank you for being with us. I just want to, of course, note that you are also an activist with the Gaza group, and you were present on the flotilla back in 2008, am I right?
Not in 2008, I was there in 2011. 2011, that's correct. We were trying to break the blockade and the siege on Gaza, which is another example of repression over a population, mostly, it's known to be the biggest open-air prison on earth. And unfortunately, like the case with Syria and the case in Iraq, the international community is looking aside. We have there over 1,700,000 people, in which over 1,200,000 are refugees. They live with very little. They live without medication. They live without infrastructures. A lot of the buildings have been knocked down. The borders, even Egypt at this point, is playing a role very close to Israel by closing the Rafah border. It's not even allowing people to go out for treatment. Mm-hmm. So indeed, it's a very, very tragic situation. That letter of that Iraqi girl from the United States, I think it could also be actually written for the Gaza case. As a matter of fact, one of the ships that came in the flotilla with us in 2011, it was the American fleet, and they brought 3,000 or 4,000 letters from children from the United States for the children of Gaza, wishing the very best and hoping that the blockade would be finally stopped, criminal blockade, so the Gaza people and eventually, actually, all the people in Palestine can live freely in a secure one state.
Definitely. Of course, that letter could be sent to every single child suffering in the Arab world and all around the world. In the end, any suffering is also affecting us, and it's affecting us badly. I want to thank you for the path that you're taking as an activist, as a journalist, as a media person, because today, as the martyr fell yesterday, Haj Hassan, he sent a letter to the world that you should fight till the end, not with your weapon, but your weapon of as a pen and as words. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Alberto Garcia.
My pleasure.
Dear viewers, that's all we have on Spotlight Middle East. Thank you for watching, and peace be upon you.